Welcome, folks, to Filmstrips, the podcast which, if the world of the film we're discussing this week were real, we'd be dead already. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanigiser.
Yeah, so, yes, you're listening to a podcast by two old men.
Well, we're on the near side of very old.
Seemingly. But once again, folks, for those who are joining us for the first time, this is the podcast in which every episode we discuss a film, but we have to connect that film back to the one we discussed in the previous episode. And Andrew, what were we looking at last week?
Last week, well, Dave decided to steer us into 1998's Mark Christopher joint 54. Whatever version you can find, don't watch. But through the character of the actor Michael York, we have detoured to one of his more famous outings, a little 1976 sci-fi romp by the name of Logan's Run. And also, Dave, this is our 20th episode.
That's right. It is our 20th episode. I mean, so congratulations, Andrew. We somehow survived doing 20 of these things.
I know. It's kind of mind-blowing. Here I had this idea to, like, have a big gimmicky episode, like the 20th episode stunt spooktacular or something like that. But, life gets in the way, so instead we're just going to talk about a film as usual. But as a reward to our listeners, it's better than last week, so don't turn off the episode, please.
Yes, and hopefully by the time we're done, the audio sync will be lined up a bit more on the nose as the way it should have been. Last week, editing was very tricky. I don't know what happened, whether it was this issue of Skype or just the way in which the files got compressed when they were being exported. But, yeah, you may have noticed that our talking was a little more clipped than usual. In that case, we will do our best.
Let me freely suggest that we should start a Patreon so people can buy us gas money and we can record in the same room.
That's another option. We'll mull that one over a bit further.
First, we need a website.
There we go. So we followed Michael York to Logan's Run. And Andrew, this is your pick. So why don't you set the stage for us? What is it that we're looking at this film for, and what kind of lens do we want to bring to it?
Okay, well, I think so far we've covered a pretty broad array of topics over 20 episodes and counting, touch wood. We've looked at horror, we've looked at noir and its influence on different genres, we've looked at acid westerns, we've looked at biopics, we've looked at road comedies. We haven't really done a proper science fiction film. And Logan's Run, maybe not as highly regarded as, say, your Blade Runners, your Episode for A New Hopes, but it is a title that I was familiar with. I'll freely admit that part of my interest was it would be an excuse to watch this film and see what the hubbub was. But it also comes out in 1976, and I think for a lot of people, especially in a literary sense, and even in a filmic sense, like, this is kind of like high times for science fiction and speculative fiction as well. Would you think that's a fair estimation?
Sort of. I mean, generally with, as far as filmic sci-fi goes, there's sort of two golden eras thus far that we've consider there, which is the 1950s era of science fiction, and then the 1980s. But having said that, the 60s and 70s, particularly the late 60s and into the 70s, really provide some very politically, driven science fiction, probably, or at least more overtly politically driven science fiction than we'd seen in the past.
Yeah, and I mean, that's not necessarily to say that previous outings didn't have a social emphasis. I mean, it's hard to look at, say, the original Day the Earth Stood Still, even a text like The Thing from Outer Space, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. There's definitely a message of, like, what is the ultimate fate of mankind if we continue on as we have. In the 1970s, though, it seems that, I mean, you look at films like The Omega Man, and a lot of it seems to be like, we're using science fiction to comment on the contemporary world, and sort of, not so much like, this is what our fate will be 50 years from now, as much as this is everything going on in the world right now, writ large.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the key things. The late 60s and into the 1970s certainly provides us with a large number of dystopic science fiction films. Certainly things such as The Planet of the Apes, that little saga is known for its almost nihilistic undertones, certainly. And the idea of, you know, the paranoia over nuclear Armageddon and the end of mankind. Likewise, Charlton Heston would then proceed to appear in two other science fiction films, thus creating, you know, the, as I like to call it, the holy trilogy of Chuck Heston sci-fi movies, which are, of course, Soylent Green, in which, you know, Chuck Heston has to navigate his way through the environmental apocalypse due to overpopulation and dwindling resources, and then, of course, you know, the previously mentioned The Omega Man, in which Chuck Heston versus not-quite-vampire zombies things. I'm still not entirely sure what the heck they're supposed to be in that film, but it's certainly not Richard Matheson's book, I'll tell you that much. But
well, I mean, to be fair, neither was the film I Am Legend, but or Vincent Price's Last Man on Earth.
It's that one's pretty close, though.
Well, yeah, it's just, it's hard to assume that. If Vincent Price is humanity's last gasp for salvation, I think it's a wasted breath.
Oh, well, yeah, them's fighting words, but
it's,
all right.
It's true, though, you're right, that there is, I think, with advanced budgets and advanced technology, particularly in terms of visual effects and sound design, in the late 60s, early 1970s, it becomes possible that we have more utopian narratives, or utopian / dystopian ones, only because it's a lot easier to fully realize these theoretical worlds on screen. I mean, it almost sounds quaint to think about, you know, these films up against something like Avatar, which quite literally constructs a world for its story to inhabit, but the move sort of begins in this period. And I think Logan's Run is an interesting example, because here we have the idyllic future Earth, ... or is it? But there's also an attention to detail, and basically building sets and using locations to through and through present, like, this is a complete and cohesive else world to our own.
Yeah, so I guess to sort of bring it, you know, squarely into focus as far as the film, this particular film itself is concerned, what is the sort of genesis of this project, and sort of where does its roots lie, Andrew?
Well, this film actually has a bit of a tortured history. I mean, first off, there's what comes after, namely the year following we have Star Wars: A New Hope, and in spite of that, this film has somehow endured. But prior to that, let me just go through my notes. It's adapted from the eponymous novel by William F. Nolan and George Clayton Johnson, written in 1967, albeit with substantial changes. Now, apparently, MGM had the rights to adapting the novel as early as, I think it was, 1969, yes. George Pal was originally on board to produce it, and Richard Maybaum was supposed to write the screenplay, but the two men apparently couldn't agree on what the core themes of the film were supposed to be, and the project just got scuttled. American International Pictures, who, you know, we brought up in the context of independent cinema last episode, they offered to buy the rights to it, but they ended up lowballing. MGM said no, and then they just held on to it until 1974, when producer Saul David comes on. He is attached to the project. They finally work out a vision and a direction for it, and then David Zelig Goodman, who wrote Farewell, My Lovely the year prior, he ends up coming on board as the screenwriter, and then there's, even though it's sizably different from the novel, at least the production crew seems to be in some sort of agreement of what kind of story they're trying to tell.
Yeah, and I guess at this point it's probably good to mention what that story is. And the quick and dirty version, with, again, notes that we are probably going to spoil the hell out of this before the episode's over with, Logan's Run is the tale of a future version of Earth, where, you know, the outside world has all gone to hell, but with inside this one little citadel, this giant dome structure of it, with, it contains a fairly large-scale city. People, you know, humanity has survived. And not only survived, but thrived in the sort of utopic, idyllic world in which, you know, we get to, you know, wander about in sort of these nice color-coded garments and live, you know, without having to overwork ourselves, and at the same time indulge.
Effectively a magic central computer that's overseeing everything, administering whatever needs to be administered. Everyone has their needs provided for. It's almost like this weird sort of free love, hedonistic, spectacle-oriented society. Sounds pretty good, though, right?
You would think so, except there's two slight catches. One, people are not raised by their parents. Basically, DNA is taken from certain individuals, mixed together to give birth to babies, which are then raised in these sort of nursery environments by said computer.
Though, to be fair, mixing DNA from different individuals is still how children are raised in this world.
It's still the way how they're raised in this world. I just get the sense that basically there is much more of an artificial, you know, coming together in this case, like, hi, I'm extracting your DNA. I'll extract a bit of your DNA. Bye, see ya, and
afternoon,
maybe
sir. On your way.
There you go. Precisely. But that part's not necessarily so bad. I'm assuming, hey, at least they're being raised in some sort of environment.
Yeah, plenty of people don't like their parents, you know? So, again, not necessarily a deal breaker.
Yeah. However, there is the slight catch that basically you only get to live till you're 30. And that's measured through these life clocks, these little crystals implanted from birth into your palm, which will measure out your lifespan. And you have, and the way that this society works is if you enter, you have to enter carousel. And if you go into the carousel, odds are you're going to be renewed. In other words, some form of vaguely defined reincarnation to keep on living. Otherwise, if you are not willing to participate, however, and decide that you're going to try and, you know, cheat death at 30, what do you run into, Andrew?
Well, then people, they have to try and escape the city. They become runners. Upon which, basically, the crack team of secret police, the Sandmen, as they're called, they are fully authorized to hunt you down and destroy you by any means necessary. And that brings us to our hero, Logan, who, through a weird series of coincidences, or possibly not coincidences at all, he ends up discovering a possible location outside the city walls known as Sanctuary. And he is then tasked by the city's central computer to basically discover whether Sanctuary exists, and if so, to destroy it. But for the ruse to be completely effective, the computer ends up accelerating his life clock to basically show that he is on his last days. So he is forced to go on the run. He meets up with Jessica Six, played by Jenny Agutter, and then the two of them basically, They meet, they plan, and they decide to go on the run together to see whether or not they actually can escape the system, all the while being hunted down by Francis Six, played by Richard Jordan, who is Logan's ostensibly best friend and a fellow Sandman. So there's a lot of moving parts here, and I think the fact that this film sort of reveals its world scene by scene also means there's a lot going on. But, I mean, the plot itself is pretty straightforward. Logan doesn't want to die, so he's got to run. And there's your title right there.
Exactly. So, I mean, again, having established that, I guess maybe it's best to start in the general sense of this before we deep dive into it. And I guess, Andrew, you had never seen this film before, correct?
I had not. I had seen it referenced. It's one of those things where it's not, like, you're never going to find, say, if you look at Fox programming or anything like that, you find a lot of, you know, gags about Star Wars and that. Logan's Run doesn't pop up nearly as often, but it has been cited. So there was a certain amount of familiarity, even though I had never seen it nor read it. I only discovered last week, after watching 54, that Basil Exposition is in this movie. Yeah, so Honestly, I didn't really know what to expect other than, like, I also assumed that it was a British production, just looking at the cast, but that's not the case. It's an American film that just has, like, the most British man on the planet as its protagonist. What about you, Dave?
This is the title I was quite familiar with, because, and as I've pointed time and again on this thing, even as a kid, I was a nerd. Especially a sci-fi nerd. I would read books and things. I remember having the Entertainment Weekly sci-fi, edition at one point, which listed like the 100 science fiction films of all time. And this was listed on it, and I'd seen other references to it. So I eventually sought it out. I want to say it was in high school and watched it then, and I had a fond reaction to this thing. I remember enjoying it. I remember being pleasantly surprised by it. Wasn't my favorite by any stretch of the imagination, but it was enough to understand, like, okay, this I get why this is a film that continues to exist at the sort of edges of popular culture, as it were, where it's a title people know but isn't necessarily, as we've sort of acknowledged, it's not one of the ones that everybody goes out of the way to say, you must go see Logan's Run. It is
Yeah.
at the top of your
Because
list.
there are sort of the iconic films of like this wave of sci-fi, like 2001: A Space Odyssey, certainly Star Wars, Blade Runner would probably be their Alien. But there's also sort of the high-profile cult films, things like Silent Running and Logan's Run as well. Maybe it's a run thing. But yeah, where they're sort of just waiting slightly off stage. And I think those are usually the films that are more interesting to explore because after a point, like, what new insight can two guys doing a podcast for free on a Friday night bring to one of Kubrick's most celebrated films? You know, whereas Logan's Run, I feel like because it wasn't that mega hit, not to say that it's been slept on, but that maybe there's a bit more of a way to bring a unique perspective to it. Because this film was not hugely successful upon release, but rather, as I understand, it's through being rebroadcast on television and then with home video market, like, it ended up developing a bit of a cult following, but especially with youth audiences. So, part of me thinks that I would have a very different response to this movie if I had seen it when I was 15 as opposed to 31. But that being said, I am very eager to unpack my response to it as is.
Well, that's the thing, because this was a film, like, when we say it wasn't hugely successful, that doesn't mean that it was a box office bomb. It was enough of a hit, and so much so that there was a follow-up television series made a couple years after, in which a fair amount of the production crew who worked on the film at least helped get it established. That did not last long, but, I mean, it's certainly, they don't adapt, failed films into television series terribly
Generally
often.
not. And as we were talking right before we started recording, apparently since the mid-1990s, different studios have expressed an interest in remaking Logan's Run with contemporary tech and contemporary hip young actors and that. And various directors have been attached to the project. Alex Garland at one point was supposed to be remaking it. Nicholas Winding Refn was supposed to be remaking it. Apparently, game designer Ken Levine was working on a script. I feel like it's going to sort of fall into Akira territory where they'll renew the rights just in case they can ever get it made, but they also know that it's impossible to really remake it in a satisfying way.
See, my fear is that it's probably going to end up like Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes, where they are eventually going to do it, and it will be the gonzo mega budget version that satisfies nobody in any way, shape, or form.
And honestly, though, that was another film with Charlton Heston. Are you sure that
Yes.
we're not talking about him this week?
We're not talking about Heston. We'll get to him one day, because boy, is there a figure worth contextualizing and unpacking. But yeah, no, in this instance, Logan's Run, this is I don't know if there's a way to look at this movie without saying that it is just such a weird, strange movie from any number of angles. And I'm not just talking about in terms of its content, because as we get into the nuances of the plot and that, there is a ton of tropes and ideas that we've seen pop up later. The Matrix! But The thing there's about this
tropes,
film,
though, that we have seen pop up before in sort of the sci-fi canon.
Yes,
you know, sort of the plot, the specifics of the plot are unique to this film, but its themes and sort of like the dark side of utopia, killer robots, you know, sort of the future as Kublai Khan's pleasure dome, you know. It's this is sort of familiar territory, but I don't think any film puts it together and treats it quite like this one does.
Yeah, it doesn't. And the thing about this film is it very much, it's a weird movie in the sense that I really don't know whether the film as it is could have been made at any other point in time. A couple years too earlier or a couple years later, this film would not have been received the same or even looked the same. Because this is a film that, as we sort of acknowledged earlier, this comes right before Star Wars. And Logan's Run was not a cheap movie to make. It was a big budget film from Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer in the mid-70s, which, yeah, this is during their sort of decline period, but
the salad, you know, years.
Yeah, but this is still that they had money. They were still spending it. They still had stars and, you know, resources that they could tap into to make this thing work. And it's ostensibly trying to tackle, at least on either in terms of the mise-en-scene and, you know, subtext, political issues or things going on in the culture at large from certainly the mid to late 60s and sort of waning throughout the 1970s in terms of the youthful counterculture. And yet this movie feels like it is some bafflingly lost product of the 1950s as a production. It's seriously as if they found, you know, people from 1956 who said, yeah, we can make a sci-fi movie now, but hadn't bothered to update their approach or ideas necessarily in that entire time. And the end result is just a baffling, baffling movie as a product, both in terms of its confused politics and its production peculiarities. I'll put it like that for now. Yeah. I mean, we'll get into them in a second.
And I think you're right, though, also, because when it comes out, this is 1976. So, as I've said before, it's post a lot of things. But I think the biggest thing is, like, this is squarely at the end of the flower power movement. And sort of that brief window where everyone believed that communal living, free love, you know, or sort of rearranging existing social codes when there was a lot of support for those ideas. So the fact that this film comes out in 1976 and it's specifically changed for the film, in the novel I understand that the date of death for everyone is 21. In the film it's 30, and I feel like it's not an accident when you think about the famous counterculture expression, don't trust anybody over 30. When you place that together, it does feel deliberate, and it's hard not to see that as some kind of commentary. But the commentary, if we follow that line of thinking, comes off as very reactionary and ultimately conservative in its messaging. And that seems very at odds with a lot of science fiction. Because, you know, even with things like The Thing from Outer Space or Day the Earth Stood Still, it's not so much like, oh, well, we should stay in our lane and never look to the stars. It's just, hey, technology is accelerating. We just have to make sure that we use it responsibly, or that we can't lose sight of the better parts of our nature as we're exploring what's possible. You know, we can't be so focused on achieving what's possible that we forget what's ethical. And that's not quite the message that we get in this film.
Well, this is the thing, because, I mean, certainly once you get into the 1960s, you get, because the thing is, there are sort of dueling sides of science fiction throughout the 20th century, in which you get sort of, you know, the sort of fearful, more conservative approach to it versus the more, you know, progressive, you know, this is what things could be approach to it. And certainly when you get to the 1960s and you end up with things such as Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey, they're pushing directly into this notion of, you know, this, you know, it's getting headier, it's getting trippier, it's getting more out there, where we're certainly getting more cerebral in terms of the content itself.
Yeah, it's no longer the creature feature. It's we're not playing with gimmicks anymore. We're playing with ideas.
Yeah, and I mean, certainly, but I think this is almost coming back to that notion of this almost being like a lost 1950s movie. There is certainly in many of those science fiction works, you know, that sort of duality to them where they can be both progressive and regressive at the same time. Even Star Trek, I think, is kind of a fascinating one to look at in that sense, because so much of what's discussed about that show is how it's such a utopic vision, you know, of progress and how things can change and we can all get better. It's still this deeply colonialist text in terms of these are dudes going off into space, ostensibly to go out and learn about other cultures. Oh, and by the way, join our Federation. It's going to be awesome. It's great. Join our, you know, Starfleet, you know. Yeah, it's like, it's all, you know, everything's fine. We're all going to join together, provided it's under this banner type approach.
But I mean, we have directives. Evil people can't have directives.
Yes. But I mean, I think certainly Logan's Run isn't so far apart from science fiction in general in that sense. What it is, what I think so interesting about this thing is how polarizing the elements of this movie are in terms of what it's giving us. Because the general narrative trajectory, based upon the plot we've given, is that Logan is on the run ostensibly for a, you know, sort of covert mission.
Yeah, he's kind of the sleeper agent.
Yeah. But it's very quickly realized that over the course of this film, he rejects, you know, he very quickly rejects the world around him once he starts, you know, recognizing some of the problems within it. Almost ridiculously so, I might add, but not to foreshadow that too much yet, or foreground that too much yet. But the point is, you know, it ultimately, you know, the film, as it comes to, once he gets outside the city, and eventually it becomes a narrative of the return and the tearing down of the structures around it, and, you know, sort of becoming this revolutionary narrative, which, again, is an old, old, old sci-fi trope in many regards, whether it's, you know, we have to take down, you know, Ming the Merciless in Flash Gordon, or the Empire in Star Wars, or eventually, you know, tear down the Matrix in The Matrix over time. You know, there is that sort of weirdly progressive, you know, change the system, revolutionize it, approach to things. Except that what's kind of odd about this film is that while you kind of understand why they would want to tear the system down, what they're returning to has an oddly regressive streak, kind of,
well,
to it.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, when you're saying that we can all understand why they want to destroy the city and sort of return to this previous era. Like, I don't honestly understand why anybody would want to, because, I mean, this city maintains everything. And, like, the only argument against it is, yeah, but our city doesn't have the nuclear family unit and it doesn't have the elderly. So in the end, like, this film, it's glorious celebration of individualism and free will being possible again. Like, really all it's couched in is, like, those things are almost subordinated to the fact that, yes, people can grow old once again, and that's really the great victory.
Well, and this is the thing. I mean, I think this is where the film gets a bit confused, because I'm trying to think about how we want to get into this in a way that's going to be understandable for everyone. Oh, maybe we should back up and let's start with the run itself.
Yeah, let's get back to what Logan does best, and let's run through it ourselves.
Okay, so the key thing here about this world is the obvious dystopic, or the downside of this thing is, yes, this notion that once you hit 30, you must die, and that it's for supposedly the greater social good. So Shirley Jackson's The Lottery taken to its nth degree? I don't know. But
and, I mean, by that same token, like, there's the idea of carousel, which in the film is presented as a spectator sport. Even though it's not at all clear what's supposed to actually be happening in the carousel. Logan quickly also realizes that it's a lie. Like, carousel does not renew anybody. It just destroys them. And again, like that, go, whether you look at Shirley Jackson or you look at Duncan Jones's Moon, the idea of people being duped by this sort of regenerative promise, that's also something that reappears time and time again.
Yeah, and so far, I would say, so good for the film. And the thing about it is that I give credit to the filmmakers in this instance for is that you kind of understand that, yeah, the world, you know, aside from that one element, this is kind of a utopia in many regards, because here's, I mean, there are explicit notes to the fact that everybody seems to generally be happy. The system is working. People are fed and clothed, and okay, there are some clearly questionable elements of it, such as the fact that apparently there is this derelict section of the city where youth gangs are running wild.
And there's also this sort of de facto caste system, because everybody of a certain age range is forced to wear like the same colored dress. And it's sort of hierarchical, but it's never presented as hegemonic the same way that something like The Handmaid's Tale does, with its vision of dystopia. So I feel like that's one of those areas where maybe the message would be more effective if they showed it being problematic a little more. Instead, like, we have blue robes and red robes passing each other on the street, and they're different, and they're kept separate, but no one really seems to have a problem with it.
Well, not only that, but I mean, one of the things is, as we sort of see throughout the film, social attitudes are fairly, you know, level-headed in this society, because again, one of the big things that we see, one of the key sequences is this notion of the circuit, which, as near as I can tell, again, not really clearly explained, is this sort of teleporting system which enables basically people to randomly hook up. And it's all based on consent. You put yourself out there, you have the option to say no. And not only, again, this leads to the sequence where, you know, Logan first meets Jessica, and they have a whole discussion over the notion of her right to choose one way or the other, as she changes her mind, which ultimately, yeah, the film sides with her, which, good on you, 1976.
Yeah, and also, good on you for predicting OkCupid and 3D printers at the same time.
This is also true. And it's also a society where, you know, as in an offhand comment, we discover that, you know, as Logan's wondering why she, you know, would go on the circuit and not want to participate, as he puts off an offhand quip about the fact that, oh, is that you're not interested in men. And it's not that that bothers him. He's just trying to get clarification on this.
And, like, especially the way Michael York plays Logan, like, he gives this sense of naivete about everything he does. And, like, so yeah, he comes off as almost, like, a whimsical and inquisitive. Because, yeah, it's not like he gets angry. It's not like he throws her down and says, oh, yeah, well, if you don't want to get with me, then clearly. And, like, starts hurling strings of insults. It's just, oh, you must be a lesbian then. Isn't that interesting?
Well, and that's the thing. And I think this will also, when we come back to Francis, I would say that there's some interesting material implied there as well, to come back to that in a little bit. But yeah, I mean, this seems to be a society that is relatively progressive in the right ways. It just has this single element that really seems to botch things up. And I think it's very telling that we never have a clear understanding as to how humanity fully botched the job prior to this entire situation as well. Yeah. We know it's a dystopic future.
I understand that the novel goes into a lot more detail on how this world is created. Like, we're given that opening title card that basically says, at this point in time, the Earth is a wasteland, and now everyone lives in the city. But we're never given any idea of how this city was created, how this computer was created, at what point the computer rationalized that in order to make life on Earth sustainable, I'll give you everything, but no one can live past 30. Because honestly, like, that's a pretty reasonable trade-off if the alternative is scavenging for whatever you can find in a dystopian wasteland.
Well, and as the film goes forward, I think one of the things that it gets right is the notion of that once we get to the outside world later on and we discover that, okay, it's, you know, obviously there are ruins of the old world on the outside, but from an environmental standpoint, it seems you could easily survive outside this globe again.
Well, I mean by virtue of the fact that they all do.
Yeah, but I mean, it's one of these things where you look at it and understand that, okay, this is ostensibly a film about a system that has outlived its usefulness and the need to reform it. So again, kudos, at least in theory, thus far. The problem is, once you get into it, it ends up being attached to some weird quasi, again, as we sort of know, some weird quasi-regressive notions, as the film ends up becoming about Logan's journey to, you know, not only join Jessica, but in a way, his friendship with Francis that he ends up rejecting. And I sort of was noting there, not again to dwell on this, because again, it is one of the oldest analytical tricks, I'd say, in the book, but the notion of the sort of homoerotic subtext there, because of the closeness of their relationship, and because of the fact that the film does present situations which would be suggest a greater degree of closeness, such as, for example, that scene where Logan meets Jessica for the first time before she leaves. What does Francis do? He shows up to Logan's, apartment with another date for him and that, so they can all presumably go off and do who knows what.
Yeah, behind closed doors. They'll go to that club they run through later. But I think I think there's some merit to that, given that the film certainly intimates that sexual attitudes are a bit more open in this world. The sort of closeness of Francis and Logan, not just because they're both sandmen, apparently they're presumably would be many others, but also these guys are pals, and like when they track down the runner that they find at the beginning of the film, they almost do it as if it's a sport. Like they're giggling and like laughing as they deliberately miss a man that they have cornered into an alley, and it's like there's a sense of gamesmanship about it. But also even the moment we're introduced to Logan, like he's looking at all the new children in the breeding facility or whatever, and he's just sort of like looking wistfully. Francis is the one who joins him, and they both start talking about like the idea of artificial birth. And in a weird sense, it's almost like the two of them are looking at their children in a certain way. It's almost like they supplant kind of the domestic relationship to some degree. If you want to follow that to its logical conclusion, I mean, Logan goes on the run more or less when he starts hooking up with Jessica, and only when he goes on the run does Francis get deployed to take him down. So I think the idea of pursuing Logan and Jessica to destroy them, that definitely would continue that reading of sort of repressed or not even repressed desire.
Well, not only that, but I mean, the way in which the running begins, Francis goes out of his way repeatedly early on. It's like, look, I get that maybe you've lost your mind a little bit, Logan, but look, I've covered for you. You know, we can still turn this around. Like, he's still trying to get his friend back as he sees it. And, you know, it's very telling that, you know, it's only when, you know, Logan makes kind of a very firm rejection of him at that point that it suddenly becomes more of an obsessive quest to get him back, as it stands. But I mean, there is on one hand then this sort of oddly regressive streak to that, where it's become, where, you know, the film is dependent upon Logan's ultimate rejection of this homoerotic or homosexual relationship or bisexual relationship, however you want to term it, because the film never has, you know, pins it down in any particular way, which again, good on it, but
you're right. Certainly, sort of by ending with the restoration of the idea of man and wife, that suddenly becomes a lot more loaded.
Yeah, exactly. And on one hand, there is that aspect to it where suddenly it's like, okay, this is a regression, and oh, we're discovering it through this old man who's, you know, was raised by a mother and father, and they seem to understand that as being somehow a benefit, even though clearly Peter Unistov's old man, who, yes, that's literally what he's billed as, folks, is clearly not quite all there. So,
saying that because he's quoting T.S. Eliot's poetry randomly while sitting in the Capitol building surrounded by cats.
Cats. I think that's a fair assessment, yeah, though.
Toxoplasmosis tears families apart.
But you have that aspect of it, but then again, the way in which they bring back the notion of man and wife, it's not like it's a regression built upon an understanding of what those values and terminology and social structures were prior. Yeah, it's not a, just a...
That, Logan and Jessica are going through what they discover to be a graveyard, and they're looking at the headstones, and they're like, devoted father, loving husband. I wonder what that means. And, like, there is that sense of they're intrigued by it because it sounds neat, but they also don't have any fundamental understanding of what these things are.
And there's no indication that the old man himself does really all that much either. He's just a byproduct who, he remembers things, he remembers aspects of his family, but that's about the extent of it. I don't think he's gonna, you know, when this film's over with, he's turning around and it's like, okay, and here's the, you know, long-term history of marriage as it was constituted in the United States of America between 1953 and 1966. You know, it's not...
Yeah, it's not like we get a five-minute monologue about the original dowry. Yeah. So, yeah, it's just they understand, like... He is there to show them that a world outside of the city is possible. And, I mean, it kind of begs the question of, well, couldn't they have figured it out by the fact that they stepped outside the city and didn't die immediately? But, you know, that it's sci-fi. Not everything has to be plausible. Yeah, it's just, there's a lot of really strange back and forths. And, like, you know, again, and I feel like a lot of it is couched in almost this attitude the film takes of, well, yeah, everything the hippies talked about was pretty good. Or was it? And, like, especially as they're running through the city and, like, they encounter... It's almost gamic, in a sense, where... Because we don't have that overall establishment of the city and its world and how it's broken into sectors. We only discover it as they go through it. And what that means is this is a film that builds its world scene by scene. So they encounter the group of the young hooligans who, like, live not in the city, but, like, in the rundown areas, sort of like the youth gone wild. So we see, like, youth gangs, like the idea of young countercultural rebellion. But they're also villainized and easily dispatched by Logan. We see them escape through basically a sex club, which, again, the idea is like, hey, free love, it's wonderful, right? But the way it's shot and staged, like, it comes off as, like, claustrophobic and terrifying.
Yeah, and apparently that was one of the sequences they had to shave down in order to get a PG rating on this film, which I find fascinating that this film, again, to show you how social attitudes and culture have changed, a film with fairly rampant nudity throughout, and yeah, a sequence running through a sex club has a PG rating, folks.
Well, yeah, it's so, also interesting where if this film really does have, like, this conservative position, that they would be so concerned with marketing it to young audiences. It's basically like, yeah, hey kids, this film is going to teach you why all the things you like, you don't really like. I think another part that prevents it all from gelling as well is not only, like, when I say it has that gamic structure, it's like, it really does feel like this is a film where it goes through different levels, right? Where it's like, here's the ice cave level, here's the lost forest level, here's the technologized city level. And the problem is, it's... Well, let me ask you this way. What do you think about the set design of the film? Because about half of it was shot on set, and about another half of it was shot at various locations between, like, Dallas and Fort Worth, Texas. So some of the environments are actual real places.
Well, this is the thing about this movie, is when I keep referring to it almost as this lost 1950s film, it's because despite the fact that this is coming out a year before Star Wars and has come out after 2001: A Space Odyssey, you know, one of the, you know, to this day, one of the most vibrantly realized science fiction films of all time, this film is so stage bound and artificial, and not in a way where, for example, when we discuss Dario Argento, there seems to be at least that's an aesthetic choice. This seems to be the case of, we have a bunch of people who, in the case of director Michael Anderson, you know, somebody who'd been working on so many classic Hollywood big budget productions like Around the World in 80 Days, and similar such films throughout the 40s, 50s, and 60s,
yeah,
before he even gets to this film.
Actually, we should probably take a moment and mention Michael Anderson, because I realize I didn't acknowledge him as the director before. It's also very odd because, like, Kubrick wasn't known for working in sci-fi when he made 2001, but 2001 also isn't a conventional science fiction film. And in a lot of ways, Logan's Run seems positioned to be one, but Michael Anderson is not a science fiction director. Like, he's worked in, yeah, as you said, many different genre pieces, but, like, a lot of literary adaptations, and weirdly enough, like, a 1950s adaptation of George Orwell's 1984, and looking over his filmography, I'm 90% convinced that that is the sole reason why he was put on this project.
And it could be. I would imagine part of it also probably comes from the fact, I mean, again, you know, this is an MGM film, and, you know, again, MGM specialized in these sort of big scale, you know, spectacle blockbusters. And again, Anderson's career does dovetail with that. So I could see them looking at him and saying, well, he's done special effects. He's done, you know, big elaborate sets. He'll know what he's doing. And again, as much credit as I think we're giving this movie, I also would note that nothing that Anderson does in this movie feels like he has a sense of how to do sci-fi. I think almost the stuff that we can give it credit for almost feels accidental, such as the inner environments of the city feeling almost mall-esque, I think is a byproduct of certain choices rather than this was a deliberate aesthetic effect. Because,
and I think they actually were filmed in what was then a shopping mall as well.
Probably. But then you get things such as, you know, probably my favorite terrible effects in the movie, which is the scale model of the city, which it's fascinating, again, looking at this and realizing, you know, miniature models can be, you know, to sell large-scale environments can be done amazingly well. 6 years from now, you get Blade Runner, which is made extensive use of, you know, small-scale models to establish its cityscape. Beautifully done. Again, models have been used throughout any number of science fiction and fantasy environments throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and has been reasonably done. This film builds a model, but doesn't bother to detail it remotely enough to sell it as being anything other than a giant model, or than this small-scale model.
I would disagree with you there, only because I think there's a distinction. Like, the opening shots of the city, you can tell that, like, it's miniature and matte work. I think it looks reasonably well. The problem is, and, like, even when, like, the sort of the car pods are traveling by tubes through the city and, like, it pans up to the buildings, it looks reasonably well constructed, well integrated. The problem is that, like, especially by the end when the city is falling apart and suddenly the models are forced to be dynamic and there's action, that's when the seams really start to show.
The thing about it is whenever you cut to those model shots, it feels like I'm suddenly watching an episode of Thunderbirds as opposed to, you know, watching an integrated environment. And this is not about a question of realism, because I'm not looking for realism in this film. It's just a matter of, for a film that's all about creating an alternative world that is supposedly, you know, ostensibly a possibility of the future, you know, it's astonishing how poor it looks despite being a big budget film. And again, 1 year later you get Star Wars, a film where, you know, say what you will, that's also a film shot on sets, but the environments of that film feel lived in. They feel fully realized in a way that you don't see in this film. And probably one of the most telling aspects is the ice cave, which, aside from being in kind of an obvious set, but, you know, again, they're beautifully built sets, but obviously sets on a soundstage somewhere. are there. It also includes The Box. And man, oh man, if you want to talk about the, you know, questionable decision-making on this film in terms of production design and special effects.
Or even dialogue and storytelling. Like, this scene really feels like, if it didn't look in accordance with the rest of the film, it honestly feels like a scene from a different movie.
Well, the thing about it is it thematically makes sense. Because basically, what we're talking about, The Box is a robot that once Logan and Jessica escape the city, it's the first thing they come across as they're continuing their journey for Sanctuary. And at first, it sort of seems like this benign creature, but what they kind of quickly realize when it shows them what happened to the others, it's a robot that, you know, can't let go of its programming. And once the basis for, you know, collecting, you know, protein and fish and all these things, that's part of it.
Let's give it its proper credit. Fish, plankton, right. Sea greens, protein of the sea.
Yes. You know, these things that he's supposed to be looking after and maintaining and, you know, in the creation of presumably the food supply from before this great catastrophe took place. Whenever these people have made it outside of the city looking for sanctuary, he's just frozen them in a cave and preserving them as, you know, to be, I'm assuming, eaten by
now,
someone.
Apparently the novel explains this more, that Box is originally designed to be like a food harvesting robot. It can venture out into the inhospitable world. It can freeze any kind of sea-based food, I guess, and then bring it back to the city. But then its programming gets corrupted, and then either, like, it becomes aware of its own obsolescence or something, and then starts identifying all living things that it comes across as sea life, and therefore tries to freeze them and then extract them. But that's also not brought up in the movie, so instead, we're immediately introduced to a 1950s-style, like, Forbidden Planet-esque robot down to, like, the box base and the square wheels and everything. So it's like, you know, once he went haywire, it's like, just tip him over. But he's also got, like, that shiny metal, almost oily look to it, where it... the effects on that just look so cheap. But then we go from what's kind of, like, a straight-laced... as straight-laced as, like, this kind of story can be, to all of a sudden a robot running in and just effectively monologuing and then screaming at the top of its lungs and then repeating dialogue about fish and plankton and then eventually trying to attack them, all before you get a stable sense of why any of this is even happening.
Well, and this is the thing. I mean, to speak to it again, thematically, it makes sense. What's happening with Box is basically an echo of what's going on inside the city, what the whole system is doing. It's operating despite the fact that its purpose has long since ceased to be, you know, unnecessary, as it were. And the result is, you know, it's leading to unnecessary death. It is leading to unnecessary actions being taken.
That's a good point, and I hadn't considered that.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I get why it's there thematically, but the execution of it is so staggeringly bad. First of all, I mean, let's talk about poor Roscoe Lee Brown, who's not only voicing Box, he's in the bloody costume. And if you have any questions about him being in the bloody costume, don't worry. When you get the big close-up on the face of this thing, whenever it opens his mouth, you can see his mouth back in behind the obvious mask there. And God bless him that he's trying his heart out to make this thing work, but he can't. But what kills me is it's not just that the effect is bad. It's that literally 20 years before this, we had Robbie the Robot done in Forbidden Planet. And when Robbie the Robot, 20 years ago, still looks better than your contemporary special effect, which is basically a dude in a costume that he can barely move around in and looks like it was designed by, you know, a bunch of kids using whatever sort of ductwork materials
the
they had
available
to them.
The Little Rascals present Logan's Run. All that's really missing is a visible zipper. But I mean, it's even weirder though, because it looks so shoddy and so poor. And one of the first lines upon introduction though is, "I am box, overwhelming, am I not?" And it's like, that is such a strange thing for a robot to say. Also, the answer is no, you are not overwhelming. You look terrible.
Well, you look terrible, and I mean, but again, this is then followed by, a sequence where Logan, having destroyed Box in, a matter of seconds by firing at it, ends up, the cave sort of starts collapsing around him, which leads to this terrible optical effect in of being overlaid to the screen of things falling. And again, it's the kind of effect you would not be surprised to see in, say, a 1950 sci-fi film or a lower budget, AIP picture.
Or like a
And it's
1930s serial, you know? They have to escape the collapsing temple.
exactly, and it's sort of like the whole the my general feeling is that either Anderson had no real sense of how to shoot the stuff, and I don't think he does, because it's very clear that most of the staging in this film is kind of weird and awkward and feels like a guy who's just sort of like, well, that's kind of how they did it in other science fiction films, right? The kids will get this, huh? And part number one, but part two, it's also just the sense that, I mean, the attitude on the side of the production crew, at least, was good enough. It's everything is, the sets are great. Could we light them in a way that's maybe a bit, less, overlit and overly
Yeah,
bright?
we don't want to stand out too much.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is that sense of pretty good is good enough that kind of runs through it. I think it's also worth mentioning that the cinematographer on the film was Ernest Laszlo, who
Yeah.
also had worked, in the studios for quite some time, probably most notably for Kiss Me Deadly. But that again begs the question of, like, so you have a director that's not well versed in sci-fi, and you also have a cinematographer that's not terribly well versed in sci-fi. So even though they have this tech and they have all these interesting ideas, neither of them are really experienced with putting it together. And I think that may be why, like, for all the detail in the design and the mise-en-scène, there's this tangible sense of flatness to it. And
Yeah.
like, as I mentioned before, like, animation is something I really enjoy, but like animated films, there's what we call multiplanarity to the image, where when you're what you see in an animated film is actually several overlapping layers that can be moved independently of one another. And certain effects, particularly the lasers in the plastic surgeon's office, they come off as very floaty and like untethered from the world. And like, that's not to say that all of the optical effects in this film are poor, but there are these moments where, it really feels almost like they drew it on the screen that you're viewing it on, rather than anything happening within the film world itself.
Well, and it's the thing. I get the feeling. I mean, again, not to keep harping on the sort of Star Wars comparison, but when you look at that film, you get the feeling that everybody, I mean, a good chunk of the people who worked on that film were substantially younger, and they were up and comers in their career. But part of it was you get the feeling that everybody involved in that film, these are people who grew up, they love sci-fi, they always wanted to achieve a great science fiction film, and they saw this as their shot. It's like, yes, we're gonna do this, we get it, we want to see what we've always dreamed of seeing on screen. I don't know whether Michael Anderson ever grew up reading science fiction. I don't know if anybody involved in this film really cared for sci-fi. I mean, because again, most of these people came up when in the sort of 40s and 50s when, yeah, science fiction was typically the B movie. So for them, that's kind of seems to be the way they're treating it, where it's like, yeah, we're doing it on a larger budget, but so what? I mean, it's better than you would have seen, in a Republic picture serial by some degree. So guess what? They'll eat it up. And I don't think they're necessarily wrong necessarily in that attitude, but I think this also, accounts for why, suddenly when you get into the 1980s, there is such that radical shift where you start seeing it for not always, but more and more science fiction being treated by people whose goal is to, take it seriously, take, you know, at the very least, bring their A game to it. Like, again, Star Trek the Motion Picture, which comes up 2 years after Logan's Run. Robert Weiss is, you know, again, probably of the same generation. I mean, certainly, this is a guy whose career dates back to Citizen Kane, but by God, he seems to be giving that film his all throughout. You can't knock him for lack of effort in terms of what he's putting together.
Well, that being said, though, the film does achieve some pretty interesting effects. And I think there are some examples of not only effects that succeed, but are also unique to this film, or at least certainly in its context. After they kill the runner in the opening scene, they basically call like these sort of security droids that come by and basically dissolve the body. And it certainly doesn't look state of the art to contemporary audiences, but they pull it off pretty well. The hologram effects, especially during the climax of the film, I think look really good. It's a unique look, and they pull it off and integrate it very well, even though, I mean, we'll get to the climax itself. But, I mean, that effect clearly could not have been easy to pull off, and they did it masterfully there. It's just, it's like, you can't... This film is frustrating because for everything it does that's progressive, there's something regressive. For every bit of world building and effects that does work, there's an equal number that do not.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that's ultimately... Part of me almost wonders whether this is a byproduct of this being an MGM release. Because... And that's not a knock on MGM, but again, this was, you know, a studio in its dwindling days, and yet here it is producing, you know, a film from basically what would have been, you know, like the MGM old guard on stands here. And I can't speak to what the culture at the studio was at that point or how, you know, cinema was being approached, but I think it's certainly notable that 20th Century Fox was, cranking out more top-tier science fiction films, or, you know, Paramount was really putting in an A-game. Like, ones where the studio seemed to have reasonably evolved with the time in a way that I don't think MGM did then, and certainly I think it's struggled with throughout its entire existence of the past 40, 50 years.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I mean, that kind of frustrates, I think, our attempt to, like, discuss the film in a unified sense as well. Because this film really does seem to resist like a broad reading of it. I'm just trying to think here of possible avenues we can go. Oh, there is one thing though that I think succeeds remarkably well. Actually, first off, on the notion of mise-en-scène, though, the moment they're out of the city, especially like the when they come across the Capitol building, I think looks really, really good, especially like as they're approaching and the steps are overgrown with ivy and even the interior building is like basically overgrown and has returned to nature. Like that works. And I'm pretty sure it's also because I don't imagine that they would have gotten permission to shoot at the Capitol building, but the set they built to recreate it, like, it has that sense of lived-inness that a lot of the city scenes are sorely lacking.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. It is, you know, that stuff handles well. And again, I don't think it's a mistake that here is something that they can at least reasonably build off of something which they either understand or at least, you know, there's something authentic and real that they can go back to looking towards. Assuming that these just weren't leftover sets from, you know, a production of Young Mr. Lincoln or who knows what.
Leftover for quite some time. Microwave it twice as long. That explains why in the background I could see Henry Fonda eating two pies at once. And the benefit is they didn't even need to spend as much on lighting because it was moon bright. A joke that maybe four people get, none of whom are listening. That being said, though, there is one element of the world that I think is crucial to the film's vibe and I think succeeds almost universally, and that is the score by Jerry Goldsmith.
Abso-freaking-lutely. Goldsmith's score is... Man, this is the kind of science fiction score we rarely see anymore, in terms of how experimental and out there and non-traditional it is.
Yeah, because it would be one thing to do kind of like the Vangelis approach and do everything on a synthesizer. It would be another to just get like deliberately, you know, associated with weirdness instruments. Like, he's not playing a theremin and a water phone here, but like there's a similar bifurcation. Like, we talked about how in Superman, one of the real strong aspects of John Williams' score in that film is that depending on the scene and its location, that the music changes around it. And nothing as complex as what Williams is doing happens here, but there is that sort of demarcation where in the city it's almost exclusively electronic instrumentation, and then the moment that they get out of the city, it's almost exclusively organic instruments, analog stuff. And that, again, gives that very real sense of, you know, the two sides of the binary that Logan needs to choose between.
No, you're absolutely right. And I mean, again, I don't know to what degree Williams was consulted with the filmmakers on this, but I mean, the end result is, number one, thematically appropriate for the finished film, to say the least, but it's also fascinating to listen to it on its own. Like, I'm certainly the electronic components, stuff such as the carousel music. Yeah, I've listened to tracks from it on its own away from the film, and it's, you know, it's not hummable music in the sense of like the Williams theme where, you know, you can sing a tune, but it is atonal when it's in an appropriate way. There's elements of it that are just, you know, really create a great sense of atmosphere.
Yeah, and like Goldsmith is not afraid to use dissonant effects to the point where, like, especially when Logan first approaches the computer and is given his mission, there's the underlying score, but then it just gets spiked by like blasts of feedback and things like that. So it's very jarring because it's so unlike how most films are conventionally scored, but I think it works really well with the tone and the visual design and just like the style of the film.
No, you're absolutely right. And then when you get to sequences such, again, as the chase through the love store, sort of midway through the film, where there is almost, it's a horror vibe without becoming, you know, a traditionally horrific score in a way, where this idea of them just sort of being mobbed by these just massive bodies as it's being matched with the score, that's the only real thing you can hear on it, is just remarkably executed in the final product. So, I mean, you know, I mean, I would be willing to put it down that Goldsmith's score is one of the reasons that this film holds together as well as it does. Because I'm trying to imagine this in the hands of yet another throwback-style composer at this point. Or even, you know, and I say this to somebody who loves the work of Les Baxter, but I could just see Les Baxter going in and just doing some random jazz composition that would feel completely out of place with this thing.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, if you even think about, like, contemporaneous hip soundtracks, like, try to think, for some reason, I kept imagining, like, what if Antonioni's blow up the score from that, like, as a similar period, trying to be, like, a youth-oriented film. Like, that wouldn't work here. Like, and I think the only thing that would work with the images we're seeing and just the weirdness of it would be what Goldsmith gives us. Like, I can't imagine anything else working.
No, not really. I mean, in some ways, I mean, you know, if Tangerine Dream were around and working at this point, I could see them maybe scoring it, but that's still too far ahead of it, the time for them to be getting involved in a project like this.
But though that does sound awesome. Yeah. I'm just trying to think, like, yeah, so far we've talked a lot, and I'm not even sure that we've actually, like, pulled out a major thread here. Let's talk about the ending, though, because yep. I don't think I'm being unfair to say that this film's climax is very weak.
This film's climax is basically a third-rate Star Trek episode from 1968, is what it is. Because it's the classic Star Trek conclusion to many episodes where the mission, you know, the system is torn down in less than 10 minutes because Logan ostensibly presents it with a conundrum that it cannot logically figure out, right. Which
well, to fill
doesn't
in,
really make sense.
Fill in, after they meet the old man and they spend a while just like learning that, hey, fathers and mothers were things back then, they basically decide to go back to the city and sort of spread the word. And that leads to those great shots of Michael York with like all the anguish on his face. Screen. Carousel is alive! And then they're basically captured and dragged to the central computer, who demands to know what Logan has learned about Sanctuary. And at this point, Logan's realized there's no such thing as Sanctuary, like all the people escaping. They didn't really escape, they were just frozen by Box. And that this Eden everyone's running to isn't actually real. And apparently because the machine can only understand in pure binaries, whether, like, that he either found it or he didn't, this causes the machine to basically go haywire and explode. But this whole sequence consists of Michael York sitting in a chair while the camera pans around to multiple holograms of his face, repeating the phrase, "There is no sanctuary," and the music just swelling until the computer malfunctions. But effectively what we're seeing is, like, the climax of this film is a guy sitting in a chair answering questions. And when there's so much going on in the early part of the film, he comes off as very odd. And I think it's because the moment that they get out of the city, the narrative slows down considerably, almost to the point of, like, doing a full stop. And that having some downtime isn't a problem. But when you have an extended period of downtime immediately before the climax of the film, it really takes some of the teeth out of it.
Well, it's the thing, because literally, once Logan decides to go back to the city, it's, you know, this is handled in a very quick montage of walking back in the course of like a minute. In for a section that took about, you know, to get to what the ruins of Washington
was.
It's
like 90 minutes to get there.
Yeah. And this thing here is suddenly, okay, they've made their way back. And then I was taking a look at the time, like, it's like, yeah, this movie is 10 minutes to wrap up. And again, I'm trying to remember, it's like, I know it involves a, you know, computer conundrum, but that seems shockingly quick to, you know, sort of burn through it. Because it almost feels like they had no other way to end this movie. Like, they hadn't, no understanding, because ostensibly what they wanted was, again, this sort of revolutionary ending where Logan goes back and quote unquote frees the people, i.e., you know, puts them into an environment in which they have no actual skills in order to survive. But the thing about it here is that it's just, it feels so, I mean, the execution is visually interesting.
Yeah. Like terms of its composition, it's one of the most, effective aesthetic scenes in the film, but all we're seeing is, yeah, there's no moment where he overthrows anything. There's no moment where he causes the people to rise up. He sits down and complies with instructions and tells the machine exactly what he knows. And when you think about, like, the whole plot of the film gets put in motion by him discovering this Ankh carried by the dead runner, and then coincidentally realizing that Jessica has the same symbol on her. Like, a lot of the plotting of this film feels very accidental and contingent.
Well, no, you're not wrong. It is. And I think this is part and parcel of this. Like, I'm trying to honestly put myself in the mindset of what the goal of what they were trying to achieve with the ending of this film is, because ultimately, you're right. I mean, this isn't a big, you know, thrilling character moment where he overthrows the machine. And it's not even a question. It's just, you know, it would make probably more sense. Imagine if this film had been, you know, Francis or somebody else did capture them and drag them back. there. I mean, I think that would make far more sense at the end of the day than the version where he goes back and his big plan is just to start yelling people outside of Carousel. Like, yes, it's bad. It's terrible. Please read my billboard.
Just teach the conspiracy. Carousel is a lie. Carousel is an inside job. But yeah, like, almost I feel like the confrontation with Francis at the Capitol, that feels more like a climax, because they have this drag-out fight between them, including bludgeoning each other with the American flag, and, you know, then Francis gets mortally wounded, and Logan runs over and, like, watches him die in his arms. But Francis, there's that neat little twist where he looks at Logan's life crystal, notices it's blank, and then he gets like that laconic smile, and he's like, ah, so renewal is possible. And then he dies contented. And I almost feel like that could have been an effective climax, but then all the story would be is Logan and Jessica discovering that they can live outside the city.
Which, to be entirely fair, I wouldn't necessarily be against. I mean, the notion of here's them pretty much having to act as a, you know, to put it in sort of Christian mythos terms, the idea of the new Adam and Eve, you know, whose now goal is to repopulate the garden, as it were, you know, that, you know, from a, you know, mythos or mythological sort of subtextual idea could work. I think for the kind of film it is, it's just, it feels like they really felt they needed to somehow have this big overthrow of the system, but why? Yeah. I mean,
it's like, well, we built all these models, and I mean, we made them look terrible, so we look forward to blowing them up. So don't tell us now that we can't.
Well, but this is also the thing that kind of throws me, it's the same problem I have with things with, you know, even to come back to The Matrix, which I, you know, jokingly mocked earlier as being very similar in terms of Logan's run in terms of some of the tropes and that it's dealing with. But there's a film that's effectively about a group of people trying to overthrow a system that has everybody enslaved to it. But the question is, why? Why would they want to overthrow this thing? Number one is my first question, because the world is terrible outside the system. Like, why? What are you hoping to achieve by getting back out of it? Number two, most of the people, you know, from the city, they're going to die. I mean, there's no way to get around it, because nobody in that city has remotely the survival skills necessary.
Yeah, like, because we're not given a whole lot of world building, but everything that's there establishes people are only alive because they're wholly dependent on the computer and its ability to manage the city and cater to everybody's needs. So, I mean, with most sci-fi, with most fiction, you know, the moment that you hold up a microscope, like, you can find areas where it falls apart. But this is one of those cases where, like, the immediate reactionary thought to watching this ending is that none of this is going to go well. Like, it doesn't sustain plausibility for any longer than it takes to watch the scene.
Well, and that's the thing, and it's very notable that the film ends with people bafflingly walking out onto the top of the city for, you know, out of God knows where. I'm still not sure where all those people were exiting from. You know, was the city built with, oh, here's these exit doors, but don't use them.
Exactly. So everyone has to promise, otherwise this won't work. And also the fact that, he liberates the city by blowing up the computer and about half of the people within it being generous there. But also, I mean, I think it's a testament to just how odd this film's own message is that people don't walk out and celebrate their freedom or throw Logan up on their shoulders as their liberator. Instead, everybody walks out and it's like, hey, look, it's Peter Ustinov. Let's go touch his beard. And, like, everyone's thrilled because they discover that old people are possible.
Well, that's just it. Like, I mean, if I were Logan at that point, I wouldn't even mention that I was responsible for what just took place.
Exactly, just tug the collar and blend in.
Exactly. But again, it's kind of like, see, here's Ustinov. You can be old. What else are they going to get out of this? I mean, okay, let's all head back inside. Oh, you mean the defective city that's broken and we don't know how to repair it because we bothered to learn the skills of how to do plastic surgery, but mechanical repair and operation of this entire, you know, sphere, not so much.
Or, you know, he lifts up a panel and he's like, yep, see, that's your problem right there. Gonna have to order out for a part. It's just like, this really, I think, would benefit from the graduate ending where everyone just sort of like smiles and then the smile fades and they're like, ugh, what now?
Well, and that's just it. And I don't know. Like, it feels so frustrating in a way where, again, almost a THX 1138 ending would make much more sense, where it is. It's just about getting out yourself because you're not going to change this system necessarily, at least not in the at this point in time in this way. And I don't know. Like, I mean, again, I'm not familiar with the sequel novels to Logan's Run. I know there was like two follow-ups to it that carried on from there. And I think one of them may have been optioned by MGM, although I would guess that probably the ending of this film is not the ending to the book, reasonably speaking.
Actually, now that I'm remembering during my research, it actually got optioned by Fox, and it takes place like 50 years in the future where Logan can grow adamantium claws out of his hands and must protect a young girl. He doesn't do as much running, just a lot of healing. And I realize the purpose of a movie like Logan's Run really is kind of on the spectacular level, but it feels like when a villain is dropping in all these little, not even commentaries, but just these odd choices in how it presents its own society and that, I feel like this is a film that wants to have it both ways, where it wants to be a thrill ride, but it also wants to be a message film, and it can't really be both of those. So instead, it sort of picks and chooses on a scene-by-scene basis, and that might lead to why this film is so oddly frustrating in analyzing.
You're not wrong. I mean, it's... I wish there was a through line that made total sense of it, but there really isn't. I mean, even when you get to the climax, it's very weird how this film that's been about this future society all of a sudden decides to squarely peg it as a particularly American addressed narrative in a way, because setting it in the ruins of Washington, having them have that moment where they come across the statue of Abraham Lincoln and wondering, oh, that's what an old person looks like, I guess. I'm sure there was a point to it other than, it being, this movie's made by Americans, but I can't tell you what it is. I don't really know what specifically about the themes of the first two thirds of this movie explicitly relate to the American politics as it stands at that time. I don't know, maybe you have thoughts on that, Andrew, that I'm missing.
I mean, maybe that's just like implicitly the appeal for young audiences to return to conservatism. If we assume that the film is like, hey, all these things that you thought were going to lead to utopia, turns out there's a dark side, but you know what endures? Abraham Lincoln. Come on, everybody, join the party. It's a big tent. I don't know if the filmmakers know. It's just, this film feels so haphazard in some ways, and yet so tightly controlled and unified in others, which honestly, that says to me it's time that we just pick out some of the minutia in our patent pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits. What do you say, Dave?
That sounds good to me. So what kind of hits do you have first, Andrew?
All right. I think I would like to give my first hit to a performance we haven't mentioned, but that is by Farrah Fawcett Majors as, is it Holly?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. She's not quite a breakout star yet, but she's becoming popular. It feels very odd to see her just suddenly appear in this film. She is basically a receptionist in the plastic surgery clinic. She doesn't have much to do, but her initial, she's fully in Valley Girl mode, which I guess still exists in the future, but like, she's fun, she's playful, she's breathy and like very la-di-da about everything, and she does show a pretty good sense of comic timing. Because when Logan's trying to pick out what his new face is going to be so he can escape the Sandman, she keeps basically like tugging at his elbow and being like, "Dark hair, dark hair." And then the doctor finally asks, it's like, "What would you like to look like?" He's like, "Oh, basically just like me." And then he looks over at Holly, "But with some dark hair." And yeah, and then she only pops up in another scene where like she basically has PTSD from watching a bunch of murders in the clinic. And yeah. Gives, like, a tearful, like, nervous shock monologue. And then she ends up dying in a melee. So it rapidly gets less fun. But I think, you know, she understands very clearly the extent of what her character is supposed to be. And I think she does it well. The idea of, like, the idea of ditzy people in the future as, like, one of the few, like, character traits that endures across human culture and civilization is amusing to me. I did like seeing her. So, what about you, Dave?
On the acting note, I'm going to keep going here with Jenny Ogdener, who we haven't really given her due here. In the same, she gives a really strong performance, and she is stuck with what is a kind of a tricky character because she's not a proactive hero, per se. She's just sort of, in some ways, she's along for the ride, but that doesn't mean she's without any sense of agency, in this film. And a lot of the film is dependent upon the notion that, yeah, she makes choices as to who she's, where she's going to go, what she's doing, and she makes you buy into some of the more dubious notions, such as the idea that she wants to go running with Logan there, which, you know, on one hand feels like it's just sort of, you met each other like within 24 hours ago. This seems ridiculous. At the same time, you're also thinking that you're going to die by the time you're 30. So I guess most people would operate on that sort of rush into things logic.
Yeah, carpe diem, everybody. YOLO.
Yeah, but she, you know, she gives a really charming performance in this role and really sells the idea of her. She doesn't fall into the trap of that I think tends to happen with the, in quotes, strong female character where, you know, as almost a form of overcompensation, they become so overly badass, as it were. And highly super competent to the point where they're a character without any sort of flaws, which isn't necessarily any better than the sort of, you know, weak-willed shrieker of sci-fi films of old, either.
Well, it's like the debate about Ellen Ripley in Alien, where it's like, it's a very interesting character, it's a very strong character, but you can also make the argument that in achieving that strength, it's not so much that they present a positive female character as much as they degender the character in certain respects.
Yeah, and that's kind of, you know, this film, again, I don't think intentionally avoids it, but I think it's an interesting byproduct of the adaptation process that they take to the book, as it were. But again, you know, come back to Ogdener herself. Again, she gives a really fun performance. She's a blast to watch in this film. So, I mean, kudos to her. I mean, it's definitely not the flashiest role one could get, but she does well with it.
Yeah, if you want to see her actually show off a bit more range, the adaptation of Equus is quite good, and I do remember liking her a lot in that. You know, no one goes to see a sci-fi movie for, like, the Oscar-caliber performances, though, but it's, having said that, I would say that my next hit is the performances of Richard Jordan as Francis. Because I think the way he plays the character, there's enough nuance that it opens up an interesting homoerotic subtext. But I think even discounting that, he goes from like that sort of hedonistic, like carefree, you know, almost like he's a character that enjoys what he does. And there's almost that sense of like the kid pulling wings off of insects about it. And the second that Logan becomes his target, though, he flips very quickly into, like, he's basically T-1000. He is the determined hunter that will stop at nothing. And, yeah, I feel like he's able to navigate both of those modes. And, like, the early scenes, he makes an effective, like, counterpoint to Logan, and like their camaraderie feels natural and organic and believable. But when he becomes the pursuer, he also makes an effective villain. And yeah, I just think I think it works well, and I think he shows off a decent range. And I think if either of those elements of it weren't quite up to snuff, the film wouldn't be nearly as interesting. So kudos to him. And what about you, Dave?
Well, while we're on the sort of, you know, kudos train here, sort of looking at this as well, we were kind of mocking it earlier, but Peter Ustinov as the old man, he's basically given... He's not playing this for keeps or for real, folks. The character he's handed isn't what I think the more likely end result would be of a dude who's spent the bulk of his life in isolation from anything and everything around him, which would be sort of somebody who is likely deeply unstable and confused. But in the case of this film, his sort of charming, quirky old cat man, it's fine. I mean, he's fun to watch. I mean, his sort of mumbling his way through, yeah, cat poetry and other things is sort of, it's ridiculous, but it brings kind of a nice laugh late in the game when it kind of needs it. So, again, kudos, I guess.
Well, it's also an interesting subversion of, like in sci-fi and adventure narratives, the idea of the sage, right? Like Obi-Wan Kenobi as a counterpoint, you know, especially played by Alec Guinness. We believe from the outset, like, this guy is sharp. He is a master. He knows what he's talking about. Whereas Peter Ustinov here, it's just, well, yeah, we found this old man who doesn't live in our city. Naturally, he's just going to be, like, not quite all there and just sort of doddering in that. And the idea that he doesn't bring any enlightenment to the characters. Like, every question they ask him, it's just like, what were your mother and father like? And he's like, well, I don't remember. I was a baby. And it's like, I think it's a clever subversion where the one guy that could possibly answer all of their questions actually can't. And probably doesn't even know what his actual name is. You know, you can definitely sense that Ustinov is having a great deal of fun with it. And it probably goes on too long and probably is mic'd a little too inaudibly at times. But I think it is enjoyable for the most part.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I mean, so credit where credit's due. I'm waiting for the scene where Logan, you know, does come up to him. It's like, okay, so start passing upon your wisdom for how to survive.
Well, get nothing. Yourself a house cat.
Yeah.
Find a good book. That's about it.
They taught you how to read, right?
Yeah, it shows that he's been holding all of his books upside down the entire time.
Yeah.
What about the inverse of that, Dave? What are your pits that we haven't mentioned?
Oh, man. Like, I feel like we've hit upon a ton of, or the vast majority of them, but I'm going to come back to it because I know we disagreed slightly on it, but the model work in this film, it bugs me because I know model work at this point in time wasn't necessarily this bad. I mean, if this had been a BBC production and this is what they had included, that would be fine. I expected the BBC in 1976 to produce something like this.
Yeah, but 40 years prior, Fritz Lang's Metropolis, I mean, that achieves probably a greater sense of atmosphere and lived-in-ness using models. And this was also interwar Germany-level budgets, so...
Well, exactly, and that's kind of the problem with here, is that it really feels like... Okay, we had to construct this in a weekend. And hey, for a weekend job, it's not bad, but you're a major budget studio release. And again, a year from now, we get to see a Death Star on a screen here. You kind of need to up your game a little bit here, folks. But I mean, it's so telling that because whenever you cut to these model shots of the exterior of the cityscape here, you know, it's always jarring. Like, it's not like there are shots that pull it off and that are more successful than others. It is consistently bad throughout the entire thing. And you could have at least hoped that they would have, you know, dialed the lights down on at least some of these things to try and hide the cheapness and lack of detailing on these things. But again, you know, I guess they didn't have a mouse running across on, you know, the set at the same time. So that's an achievement, I guess, for these folks. So,
my God, this giant rodent will devour us all.
No. We have to use the footage.
Exactly. Yeah, we have no more money to order new film. We've got to use it. Sorry, folks. Looks like this film is about something else now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, most of the pits I think we've identified, but I'd like to give a special nod to the carousel sequence, only because it, again, this feels emblematic of a lot of things that go wrong with this film, where apparently, in planning and setting up the carousel sequence, apparently it was the most expensive part of the film to coordinate. Apparently they had to solve all sorts of technical and logistical problems. And for what? The ultimate result of it is we have a platform that spins very slowly, and then also very slowly, some people start hovering into the air on visible wires, and then eventually, like, obvious squibs detonate on their chest and they burst into flame. Like, it doesn't look good. At no point does it ever convey, like, what's actually supposed to be happening, why any of it's happening. Like, we're just told it's carousel, people have the chance to be reborn, and then we just slowly watch people hover and explode. And it's like, I don't get it. I don't see what's happening. I don't see why it's happening. It looks like a mess. And when you think that this costs more than the pretty cool hologram shots, you know something went wrong somewhere.
Well, the thing about it that really drives me at the wall is the way in which Carousel's described, it feels like this should be some sort of new age religion that they're all following.
Yeah, because it's foregrounded in that opening intertitle.
Exactly. And that's the thing about it. You never get the sense that there is a sort of quasi-religious component to it. They go in there, and it doesn't feel like it's a religious ceremony. It feels like the world's worst sporting event. Here, come see our ice figure skaters dancing on air! Yeah, you know,
opening act, arena football.
Yeah, I mean, it really just seems odd, and the way in which everybody's sort of cheering on renewal, you know, it's like, okay, what's, you know, how, why, and again, it sort of comes back also to the notion of, well, who set this up? Because if the city is operating on the basis of this computer, this whole automated system, that can't even handle the notion of, by the way, you know, Sanctuary doesn't really exist. It's just something people made up on their way to trying to get the hell out of here. I mean, I have a hard time imagining that this computer set up this quasi-fake ritual as a way to confuse and confound people into doing it, into participating and ensuring that the system maintains its operation. Because clearly, you're not that much more evolved than a punch card system.
Well, yeah.
So,
and like, everybody, regardless, all the participants end up bursting into flames, and everyone cheers for renewal in that. Like, do they think that the way some people explode means that they're going to be reborn? Or do they want people to be renewed? Do they want to just watch the spectacle of people dying? Like, for something that seems to be like a centerpiece of the film, like, nothing about it makes sense. And nothing about it is clear or visually appealing or anything. Like, it ends up being the biggest afterthought in the entire movie. Though it does prove that Logan was right. That carousel is alive!
But again, that comes back to even the notion when he's having that scene at the hot tub scene, where, you know, Logan's coming up to Francis and asking, it's like, do you know anybody who's actually been renewed? At that point, in the back of my mind, it's like, okay, wait, so is somebody supposed to have memories?
Yeah.
Because if that's the case, you would think that more than just Logan would have put a heck of a lot more people than the thousand that, what is like 1,001 people who have escaped with inexplicably, would have pieced this together and realized, hey, you know, does anybody actually know somebody who remembers getting blown up in a, you know, giant cylinder in the middle of, you know, a crowd of raging people?
Well,
I don't know.
To be fair, it was already established that the Logan lost his memories after Colonel William Stryker shot him in the head with an adamantium bullet.
See, I'm now trying to find a way to work in a Logan Lucky reference instead and try and go that route. I love that movie, man. That was, and somehow I, based upon your reaction there, I get the feeling we're going to have a fight about that one in the future.
Oh, wait, no, I was thinking of Dylan Dog. I have a thing with alliterative names. Joking about superheroes again, something tells me that we've come to the end of this particular leg of the trip.
Yes.
Any parting thoughts on Logan's Run?
You can rent it on iTunes. That's about all you need to do, folks. Seriously, you know what? If you're interested in the sci-fi canon, you know, it's not a, you're not going to be miserable when you're done watching it. I mean, it's probably worth noting, you know, if you haven't seen it already, just to at least check it off the bucket list. But I mean, you know, it's not the greatest thing you're ever going to see, and that's about the extent of it. Yeah. What about you, Andrew?
It's distinct. I think it does a number of things very well, and it does a number of things very poorly, but it's an interesting snapshot of basically like peak sci-fi a year before it was fundamentally redefined for mainstream audiences. It's messy and it's kind of incoherent and it doesn't all work, but I mean, that's the thing, especially when we broke down in Hits and Pits. It's like, even though the film itself isn't great, like there are some great performances. The soundtrack is amazing. There's some interesting effects work. Like you could do worse than spend 2 hours of your time watching this movie. Just maybe you can make a little bit more sense out of it than we could. But that being said, Dave, thank you for letting me take our pod car on rails to a utopic/dystopic future Texas dome, apparently. Where are we going to be going for our next film's trip?
Well, you may have noticed that we praised Richard Jordan quite a bit in this episode for his performance as Francis Six. And yeah, I would, you know, I think we're going to keep on the Richard Jordan train because we're going to head to 1990 to discuss a film that is, unsurprisingly topical again, because for a variety of reasons. And that is The Hunt for Red October, starring Sean Connery. Yes, he's back on the show again. And Alec Baldwin, aka the best Jack Ryan.
Honestly, Dave, until you had mentioned that, I completely forgot that we did League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yes, understandable. But yes, so does this, you know, 28-year-old film hold up? Is there much we can learn from it? And for those of you who are younger out there who wonder, what's a Cold War? Don't worry. Andrew and I will fill you in on that.
And
what
it takes
about you,
place
Andrew?
On a submarine, so we can make all sorts of Elon Musk jokes.
Of course.
Until next week's episode drops, Dave, where can people yell at you for fundamentally misunderstanding the glory of Carousel?
That would be at 24Panels on Twitter. And how about you, Andrew? Where can the people yell at you?
You can yell at me at Filmstripper, also on Twitter. Eventually, the long-promised rollout of our website, filmstrippod.wordpress.com, is going to be complete. So far, two different people I know looked at the template and said, Andrew, please, let me build a website for you. And I said okay, but I'm yet to see results for it. When that happens, though, folks, you will certainly know. Otherwise, if you have any feedback you'd like to offer, you can rate and review or subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcasting service. 5-star reviews are always welcome to see, and they are the best way to get new eyes and ears onto our show. But again, it's always better to be honest because we can't fix things if we don't know if it's broken. So if you like what you're hearing, and if you don't like what you're hearing, feel free to drop some critique.
Yeah. So until next time, Andrew, any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yes. Remember, dear listeners, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Unless, of course, that monotony is living in a hedonistic pleasure dome. But again, I digress.
Protein of the sea.
Bye.